Salutations, Mets fans, and welcome to this week's edition of Amazing Avenue Audio, the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro, and with me, back from Norway, is Rob Castellano. Rob, how was your Norwegian excursion?
Try the lutefisk, I'll say, if ever you have the opportunity.
All right, so we took a week off. The cat's out of the bag now. So here's the thing. This is going to happen on occasion. You sent me lots of tweets and emails wanting to know where episode 65 was. And look, we're not going to have a show every week. Stuff's going to happen. 90% of the time will be my fault, as it was this time. 10% of the time will probably be Comcast's fault. But that's all done and gone. We'll do two episodes this week to catch up. I appreciate that you missed us. I do have one piece of old business to dispense with. Rob, on the episode I was off, 3 weeks ago now, you screw up the Mets trivia question because you didn't count all of Hank Aaron's playoff home runs against the Mets.
Yeah, Chris and I sort of went over that, whether or not we were going to start counting the, because I think it was, I don't even remember at this point who had the most.
It was some dude.
Yeah, it was just some rando Mets pitcher had given up the most home runs to Hank Aaron, and Chris said, no, that's not right. And we realized the discrepancy was I wasn't counting playoff home runs. So if you want to count them, then I think that did change the answer, didn't it?
Yes. And it was funny because I was listening to that podcast the next morning when I was driving into work, and Howie and Josh had just talked about the 69 championship series the night before because it was Hank Aaron night. And they had mentioned that he had hit a home run off Seaver, Kuzman, and Gentry in all three games in the series, even though the Mets had swept. So it was fresh in my mind. And would have been, I still probably wouldn't have gotten it. That's trivia. But I would have taken umbrage. Not that I don't take umbrage when I get answers wrong as it is. And we'll have more Mets trivia coming up very shortly. We have taken 2 weeks off, and weird things have happened in the interim. 2 weeks ago, Colin McHugh was in AAA. Now, apparently, he's the best pitcher in baseball. That's the thing that's happened. And I couldn't be happier, frankly. I've been to a lot of baseball games. I went to New Britain to check out the Portland Sea Dogs, Boston's AA affiliate. I saw Sean Newcomb again. And I went to Lakewood this past weekend to see Savannah. We'll have more on that on our second podcast this week. And also, you sent us a lot of emails in the last 2 weeks, so we are going to spend episode 65 cleaning out our inbox with not entirely timely email discussion. So we'll catch you up on the Ike Davis trade. That's the thing that happened many weeks ago. I mean, the beat writers have already moved on from tweeting every Ike Davis at bat. That's how you know it's well in the rearview mirror.
I never thought we'd get there.
No, here we are The Lucas Duda epoch has begun. A lot of emails about Brandon Nimmo. Some emails about Cesar Pollo. More prospect-y, very prospect-heavy emails, which is always fun. But the first thing we have to do, of course, is name the episode. And I'll be perfectly honest, I was hoping they would assign Bobby Abreu 65, so I wouldn't be obligated to name this episode. I am obligated to name this episode after Doug Simon's edition. If you don't remember Doug Simons, I don't blame you. He was the 1994 Rule 5 pick of the Mets, which is probably a good reminder that the Rule 5 draft just doesn't matter. And was traded in the offseason. He pitched one season in 94, was traded in the offseason to the Expos for a guy that never got above AAA, and Simons himself spent one brief season with the Expos and was out of baseball at 25. So again, Rule 5 draft doesn't matter. But I'm not naming this episode after Doug Simons. We're getting to the point in our long storied history now where the numbers are getting a little scarce, so you need to start mixing in some other things. I'm not saying we'll go away with it entirely. We still have Gonzalez, Hermen, Turk Wendell, some interesting guys to come. But I'm going to sort of play it by ear, maybe a little reference to the Mets season or to recent news. So in honor of recent news, episode 65 will be the Ike Davis Dog is Traded edition.
So sad.
It is. So we have some emails to get to. Before that, we'll kick things off with Mets trivia. Let's have at it, Rob.
All right. I've had a couple weeks off to recharge the trivia batteries. Today, we are going to discuss the Mets through 25 games. As we know, the Mets are 14-11 through 25 games. But what I want to know is, in their history, what season did they have their best start through 25 games?
So I have like a 1 in 51 shot, basically, because I wouldn't even know where to begin here. But I will think about it, as I hope you all out there will as well. We'll come back to it at the end of the show. But now it's time for your emails. And usually, before we do emails, we do housekeeping. But it seems kind of silly to do housekeeping 5 minutes into the podcast. So hopefully, I will seamlessly weave the housekeeping in later in the show. And if not, per the rules of Drinking Avenue Audio, you'll have to finish your drink. I hope you have a drink in front of you. I do not. I did have a beer earlier this evening. I'd planned to make a Nor'easter, which is this craft cocktail. The Times posted a recipe for it this week, and it intrigued me because it had bourbon in it. I mean, basically, it's a Moscow Mule with bourbon, but that's good enough. So I went to the grocery store on the way home from work and got limes, which you may well know are very expensive. I was going to pick up ginger beer, but they had no ginger beer, so...
You know where you can find ginger beer?
Where can I find ginger beer?
Norway, actually. They've got a ton of it.
Really? That's nice. So it's. I like that your Norway trip did allow you to bring some topical knowledge to the podcast.
Absolutely. Ginger beer. Thumbs up.
Right, so no housekeeping, but you can, of course, email the podcast, as you did in great numbers over the last 2 weeks, at podcast@amazingavenueaudio.com. So get right into your emails, and our first email this week, conveniently about the Ike Davis trade, is from Michael. Hello, gents. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the Ike Davis trade. I find it troubling on several levels. First, they traded, if you might remember, in episode 64, Michael emailed us his concerns about Lucas Duda as an everyday first baseman. So this is probably a follow-up to that email. First, they traded away the wrong guy at the wrong time. Why sell low on Ike? Why not play him every day in April and then trade him? Wouldn't it have made sense to showcase him in an effort to get back more than a Rule 5 reliever and most likely a second or third round pick from last year's draft? Secondly, why trade Ike and not Duda? When looking at their stats side by side, Ike had about 4 bad months as a Met, while Duda only had about 4 good months as a Met. This, by the way, is within similar service time. Also, of course, Ike is a better defender. Losing his defense at first will have a negative effect on the entire infield, since David Wright, Ruben Tejada, and Daniel Murphy have all had issues with throwing to first in their careers. Lastly, with Ike's $3.5 million off the books, that brings the Mets to what? A $79 million payroll? I think it's actually $81. Is this the trend that we as Mets fans have to look forward to? It seems pretty well established right now. The Wilpons always look for the frugal move to be made and essentially playing chicken with the commissioner's office to see how low they can go with a New York payroll before they get the Frank McCourt treatment. Fan as always, Mike, thanks for making my commute more bearable for 1.5 to 2 hours every week. All right, the Ike Davis trade. This is a thing that happened. That's why the episode is titled Ike Davis Dog is Traded. A funny story, actually, Rob. I was trying to watch baseball when this trade came down. I was actually at New Britain Stadium for the New Britain-Portland game. And I was just doing it to see some more guys. Portland has a pretty loaded team this year, and I wanted to look at Devin Marrero, their shortstop, before I saw Cecchini this past weekend, just as sort of a level set thing, since they kind of have similar profiles and were taken in the same draft class, even though Marrero's a college guy. So I was making my notes, doing my thing, you know, checking Twitter every so often. And then the rumors started and the lineup wasn't posted and all those fun things happened. We all lived through it as members of hashtag Mets Twitter. And at some point I looked up and 5 runs had been scored in an inning, and I just had no recollection of what actually happened.
You got sucked down the Twitter rabbit hole.
It was not good hashtag scouting. But I think this is a thing that had to happen. And the Mets played chicken all offseason with, you know, the Orioles and the Pirates and the Brewers. And they just couldn't keep going with 3 first basemen on the roster. So on the one level, I get Mike's frustration that maybe you feel like they were kind of pushed into making this trade and in the end, they're not going to get good value back. But, I mean, honestly, I don't know how much value Ike had. And on the flip side, until we know exactly what they got back, for one, you can't judge the trade. And two, I think if you look at Alderson's track record, he's generally pretty stubborn in terms of holding out for what he considers good value. So I don't think, I mean, they'd gone, what, two and a half weeks with Dudas and Davis. I don't feel like they would have pushed to make a trade this early unless they got something close to what they wanted. Look, it's not Nick Kingham. It's not Tyler Glasnow. It's not Alan Hansen. But they were aiming. Yeah. And it's not going to be, you know, Austin Meadows or Reese McGuire.
Yeah, that was where I was.
Let's move that. Let's give that too. But again, Davis just didn't have that much trade value. So if they got someone like Blake Taylor or Jacoby Jones, that's pretty good value. And you know, there's been some rumors. I know Dave Gershman tweeted out that the Mets had been really interested in Jolie Rodriguez, who's hurt currently. Harold Ramirez, who's one of their top prospects, was Baseball America's number one prospect in the Penn League last year, is also injured. I mean, you don't always see player-to-be-named laters. I would imagine it's more likely as a draft class, 2013 draft pick, than a guy that's currently injured, just because that's kind of a silly way to do it. What if he stays hurt? You're kind of stuck. Maybe there's a list floating around. Ramirez is probably optimistic. He was ranked as their number nine prospect in the offseason. You know, McGuire's number eight. So he's in that same kind of class. And again, they're not getting Reese McGuire. So, I mean, they'll get somebody interesting if it's, you know, Jacoby Jones, toolsy outfielder, but he's playing at shortstop right now. But as we well know, the Mets front office, this is a great line. G-chatting someone about some Mets shortstop. It could really have been any of them at any of the affiliates right now. The line was, the Mets front office just have a different idea of what shortstop tools look like. So maybe Jacoby Jones is the kind of guy that appeals to them. But again, you're trading a guy who was awful last year, had a terrible first half the year before that, and was injured the year before that. You're just not going to get, you know, Austin Meadows or Reese McGuire or, you know, Eduardo Rodriguez or Nick Kingham or whoever the guy was they wanted from the Brewers. I don't even remember anymore.
So to be clear, it sounds like you think their return is a 2013 draft guy, because to be clear for everyone, as a 2013 draftee, he can't be traded for a year after he was drafted. So
after he was signed, actually. It's less of an issue now, obviously, because of the compressed signing period.
Yeah, so it was soon after he was drafted.
I glanced at when their pick signed. They were all, I think, within a week or so after the draft. So it'll be sometime in the middle of June. But who knows? I'm a little shocked it hasn't leaked yet. I mean, it's the kind of thing you don't, you know, you don't want to leak, especially if it's a guy that's not currently in. If it is a guy that's currently in extended, but if it's like Jacoby Jones, who's in West Virginia right now in A ball, you know, you kind of want to not to leak out that he's not going to be in West Virginia in 2 months.
And the thing is, Ike, like you said, there's so many different ways that could have played out, that it's hard to say, are they just going to get a nobody? Are they going to get a somebody? I mean, it's hard to value Ike, so it could easily be on either end of the spectrum. So it's hard to sort of peg. I mean, typically you'd have a good feel for a player and his value, and you'd sort of peg that level of value and then sort of gauge a minor league player against it. But with Ike, it's really hard to do that, so you're pretty much all over the board.
Yeah, and would I, again, you can't evaluate the trade because you don't know what the trade is yet. And would I have rather had Zach Britton, Matt Joyce, if the Matt Joyce rumor was actually true? It seems like there's a decent amount of buzz around Zach Britton that was a possibility. Sure, but I have no real problem with, I mean, this has been Alderson's MO for the last 3+ years. He's going to hold out till he can get value. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. But
yeah, I just think back to Marlon Byrd last year. And there were a lot of the, you know, similar frustrated sentiments over, you know, Alderson is doing a poor job, and you know, it was sort of turned towards the ownership, and then suddenly, you know, a month and a half later, we were singing his praises. So I mean, this feels very much like that sort of situation where let's not prematurely lambaste Alderson for a trade for a Rule 5 relief pitcher when we don't know what the other return is yet, and it could very easily end up being a significant play. We've heard from a number of the beat writers that the buzz, you know, there may not be a name, but the buzz is that it's going to be a significant player. And then, you know, if it turns out to be, then suddenly the trade really doesn't look so bad and, you know, could end up being a nice win for Sandy.
I don't even know what significant player means to, well, John Heyman, I think, was one that initially tweeted it, but
yeah,
I mean, who knows? It'll be.
Again, that's the point. We don't know.
If you believe, like I do, that Duda and Davis are fairly similar players at this point, at these respective points in their careers, you know, to trade Ike for anything, even like a, you know, a second or third round pick, and talent in the draft does drop off very quickly, but if you get, you know, Blake Taylor, who's a big projectable lefty, or maybe the kind of pitcher the Mets would go after in the draft normally. He kind of reminds me a little bit of sort of the Meisner and Church class of guys. And Jacoby Jones is certainly, it's somebody that they can convert to a shortstop, which they like to do. So he would also fit the bill, even though maybe his plate discipline isn't, or his control of the strike zone, at least currently, for a college guy, isn't that great.
Well, how about, enough about the return, because chances are we're going to, you know, profile 15 guys and all of them are going to end up not being on the other end of
it. Yeah, that's kind of how it works.
How about the idea that they sold low, as the question stated? What's your feeling on that?
I mean, how much? I mean, even Pittsburgh is basically using Ike Davis as a platoon first baseman. It's the long side of a platoon, but there's just not that much value there. And he hasn't done anything for Pittsburgh so far, really, after a hot start. But, you know, that's, it is what it is.
So you don't buy into let him play it out and bring his value up, sort of like?
I just don't think there's a way to make that happen. You know, he got all of 2012 to try and bring his value up. It didn't really work. Or excuse me, all of 2013.
Yeah, 13. 12 he was out.
Not that he was that great in 2012 either. I mean, he is what he is. He had a really, he had a good but not spectacular season in 2010, where a lot of his value was propped up by the advanced fielding metrics. In 2011, he was hurt after a fairly hot start. And then 2012, he was terrible, got sent down. Or sorry, he didn't get actually get sent down in 2012. He was terrible for two-thirds of the season and then hot for the last third. And he hit 30 home runs. Yes, he hit 30 home runs. He hit 30 home runs while he hit 220. And the defense wasn't quite there and hasn't been really since coming back from his ankle injury, both by the metrics and by the eye test. 2013, he was awful. He got sent down, came back, walked a bunch, got hurt again. And 2014, he was hurt in spring training. Oh my lord, what is that? You know, these Baseball Reference autoplay ads are getting irritating. It seems like every week this happens.
Well, I mean, generally, you have to just, anytime you hear like random music or like background dialogue, yeah, you pretty much know what it is.
Yes, it's a Baseball Reference ad. He's just not, is he a top 25 first baseman in baseball over the last 3 years? I don't even think he's that.
Yeah,
you know, contracts aside, would you rather have him or Billy Butler? Would you rather have him or James Loney? Would you rather have him or Justin Morneau? I mean, Morneau is probably closer. I mean, he's got the Coors effect going for him. But Morneau's probably closer to his talent level at this point. You know, maybe Ike Davis just isn't a very good baseball player.
Yeah, I think that's ultimately what it boils down to, that for me, he's gotten a lot of opportunities. And the question is right on. The numbers, I mean, if you look at him next to Duda, they're very similar. I mean, the Ike has got a little bit more service time and a little bit more reps under his belt, but he's 247 with a 767 OPS versus 240 with a 765 OPS. They're very, very similar players.
I don't think either are long-term answers at first base, but you just can't carry a dead roster spot like that.
Yeah, and again, I think Ike has gotten the opportunities, whereas Duda has always been sort of the second fiddle. Fit in where you fit in, basically, you know, bench, outfield, whenever Ike is hurt. But it's never, you know, he's never gotten the keys, whereas Ike has been, you know, nothing but the organization's player of the future or first baseman of the future. He's been handed the keys every season. And, you know, there have been injuries there, but after so long, it's just sort of like, you know, you had your opportunity, you had another opportunity. How many times are we going to give you your, this is it, your make or break year? I feel like it's, you know, 3 years later and it's another make or break year for him. Ultimately, give due to the opportunity that you've been giving Ike all these years. Again, he's a very similar player. Chances are the outcome won't be all that different, but at least you can say you're trying something different. The process is different and maybe hope for something better. Like you said, neither is probably the long-term solution, but at least with Duda, you know, there's some upside that maybe we haven't seen, that untapped potential of, you know, focus on hitting. Don't worry about, you know, playing outfield and learning an entirely new position where you clearly don't fit and, you know, expending a lot of stress over that. Play first base where you know how to play and just hit. And we'll see what happens.
Yeah, and I think something that gets overlooked here is, yes, they're very similar players, but they got there in very different ways. You know, Davis was a first-round pick, major league bloodlines, got, I don't want to say rushed to the majors, but maybe a little bit. Didn't really have to prove it at every level. Had a bad season in Brooklyn. No one was that worried. Hit big time in St. Lucie and in Binghamton the year after. And then in 2010, the Mets realized very quickly that Mike Jacobs was not going to be their first baseman. Davis got called up and went from there. So he never really had to struggle, make adjustments in the minors. You know, Duda had to work very hard to get where he was. He was an eighth-round draft pick who, you know, Omar Minaya very famously didn't know his name for the longest period of time. He was coming off of a Hamate injury. The power came late. He spent a couple years in AAA, just sort of having to, you know, he's more of a prove-it-at-every-level guy, and he put the work in. You know, you ask the Lucas Duda expert among our staff, Eno Cyrus, about this. You know, he worked very hard to get to, yeah, maybe about the same level of performance, but I'd rather bet on the guy that's going to work hard, that's going to tinker, that's going to grind out at bats, even if he's, you know, in the end, maybe a platoon first baseman, second division starter type.
I have to hit the pause button. What sort of injury did he have?
Was it a Hamate? He had a wrist hand thing coming out of USC.
I'm not an orthopedist.
Oh, I have no idea. I can't pronounce things. I should say it. As long as we're talking about how I can't pronounce things.
Yeah, that's exactly what I want to dwell on, because we're having like a Robert Selman moment, which turned out that I think you were right.
No, somebody told me this was not something I made up. Somebody, I don't remember who, told me it was Selman, but it's not.
I'm pretty sure I told you it was Selman.
It might have been you, but it's Gazelman.
I can't believe that.
It is, like the animal.
Gazelman. Okay, so I thought it was Gazelman.
No, it's Gazelman.
Gazelman.
Gazelman, apparently. I meant Somebody to ask did... him, but he wasn't charting either game. It didn't fall on his schedule.
So at this point, I'm not going to say hamate, because...
It's whatever, you know, that bone that saps your power and
the hand bone.
The hand bone, which is connected to the wrist bone. So yeah, Lucas Duda. He is what he is. He's got a long swing. You'll probably all be off be answer we'll be answering Alan Dykstra emails for the next 3 months. I've accepted this. He's not gonna make the All-Star team. He's not great defensively. He probably should be hitting cleanup, but he's hitting six, but fine, whatever. We have a question about the lineup later, and I'll get annoyed about that when it's more more germane to the actual email. But it's just not... It's done. It's over. You know, Duda will have to put his stamp on and win the job this year going forward. Does his approach, you know, more mirror what the front office wants out of their players? I think so. I think that's certainly part of it. You know, there's been other rumors that have flown around Davis for the last couple of years about his work habits, you know, the drunk Ike meme and whatnot. But, I mean, in the end, they're two first basemen that probably don't hit enough in general or against lefties to play first base every day. And that's, you know, and they made their decision. I think, as I said on the podcast before, maybe as soon as the last episode, which happened right before the trade, that, you know, they got to just, you have the information needed to make a decision and stick with it. And they did, and it'll either work or it won't.
Is it safe to say that this wasn't a money issue?
Eh.
I didn't get that at all. I think they
just prefer Duda to Davis. The fact that he makes more played into it a little bit, sure. It's something that goes into the calculus. But he's not making $8 million.
Yeah, I didn't think it really played in at all, to be honest.
Our next email is from Farouk, who we actually sent this 7 days ago, but everything in it is still entirely accurate. Nothing has changed. Hi, Jeff and Rob, or Chris or Greg. Mets fans are freaking out about Curtis Granderson and geeking out about Brandon Nimmo. 3 weeks is certainly too soon to draw any hard conclusions, but I wonder at what point we could draw those conclusions. How do you define an adequate sample to change your view of a player, and what are the factors that go into determining the size of that sample? Expectations seem to come into play. In this case, Granderson and Nimmo are both expected to do what they're currently doing, regress and progress, respectively. They just appear to be doing it faster and to a greater degree than anyone expected. If they keep doing what they're doing, at what point do we label Granderson the next Jason Bay and Nimmo a top prospect in baseball? How different would it be if the changes in production was not expected? Say it was Corey Vaughn with Nimmo's towards start, or Mike Trout slumping like Granderson is. Are there other factors that come into play beyond expectations? Thanks as always. I look forward to hearing your reply. Priors matter. You know, Matt Reynolds is hitting 380. He has not hit 380. Actually, I wrote these notes a while ago, but I think he's still hitting roughly 380. He hit 250 last year. He's probably not going to keep hitting 380. So Nimmo is probably not this good. I think he has a 500 batting average on balls in play, and he's 3-for-3 tonight. Granderson is probably not this bad, but there's some things happening here that are worth noting, I think. There's always going to be some risk with Granderson. It's certainly too early to call him Jason Bay, and really too early to be booing him, Mets fans. But the K rate's been going in the wrong direction for years. He was never going to hit for as much power at Citi Field, or playing his home games in Citi Field, as he did playing his home games in Yankee Stadium. I think that's overblown to a certain extent, and I think part of the power issue is he's just the bat's slow and he's popping up everything. Which also makes you nervous, the guy that's been hurt and is on the wrong side of the aging curve. Conversely, Nimmo, again, it's a high BABIP. It's going to come down. But minor league BABIP is not major league BABIP. Actually, Sylvan, one of our regular emailers, wrote a good fan post about this that's on the site this week, sort of looking at minor league BABIP and what it might mean. But look, you don't have a 500 batting average on balls in play unless you are at this level with bad defense, unless you are spraying line drives. And strikeout rates come down, and those are the kind of things, you know, K rates and walk rates that tend to stabilize fairly quickly, right around 100 plate appearances. If you really want to dig into the, you know, when statistics are worth noting, there's, of course, I'm sure I've mentioned it before on the podcast, but the Russell Carlton piece at Fangraphs on when sample sizes start to matter, which I believe is called When Sample Sizes Start to Matter, or something like that. you just search for Fangraphs and Pizza Cutter, and it comes right up. But things like swing rates, things like strike and walkout rate tend to stabilize a little bit faster than, say, you know, batting average, even any of your triple slash numbers, really. And the other thing with Nimmo is, look, he was a first-round draft pick. Dude, you know, the tools, the pedigree are there. And sometimes guys just break out. And he's not doing anything. You know, he didn't suddenly start, you know, going Joey Gallo on the league or anything like that. He's doing kind of what he did last year, just everything's turned up a notch. You know, maybe the hand's healthy. Maybe he's just on a good run, but...
Actually, I wanted to hit on that. So tonight, coming into tonight, like you mentioned, he's 3-for-3. But coming into tonight's game, he's batting 379 with one home run. Last year, through 3 weeks, he was batting 367 with one home run.
There you go.
So this is definitely not, you know, undiscovered territory for him. He's been here before, but we obviously all know what happened last year and sort of how the year got away from him. So obviously it remains to be seen what happens this year. Obviously there was a lot of mitigating factors, mainly just injury last year. But let's not act like this is completely night and day from what we've seen before from Nimmo. This is sort of par for the course from what we've seen from Nimmo, at least last year.
And as far as Granderson goes, like, are you worried about David Wright? Are you worried about Daniel Murphy? I mean, track record does matter. And a basic statistical principle is you always regress towards the largest sample size, especially when it's, you know, April 27th. I think with Granderson, there are reasons to be concerned. You know, it's the same reasons we outlined when we talked about the deal when it happened. I mean, you'd hope that this season... I don't think he's this bad. I didn't think he would be this bad, and I don't think he's this bad. You know, but could he hit 220, 320, 430 this year? Yeah. And that's not great. You know, it's probably with decent defense in a corner and average-ish kind of player. Oh, my God, dogs. I don't know what you're barking at. There's nothing...
Perhaps that batting line just really offended them.
Yeah, well, it should. It's just me with that dog, so I don't know what they're going to do. Why are you barking? I can't make Curtis Granderson stop striking out. I'm sorry.
I've tried. It doesn't work.
I mean, how concerned are you about Curtis Granderson? And Nimmo's 4-for-4 now and hit a home run.
Maybe he is going Joey Gallo in the league. I'm nervous about Granderson because, like you said, there's mitigating circumstances, namely he's old. And I brought this up at the time of the deal. He's old and he's a bounce-back player, but as much as we all love the bounce-back deal, there's lots of upside when you buy low on a guy who's coming off a bad year. Sometimes guys are just, you know, it's not so much a bounce-back as it is a career decline. And this was more a point towards Chris Young than Granderson, because obviously with Granderson there was injury at play, but he's not young, and it's a skill set that you worry could decline pretty precipitously, and Mets fans know all too well about that profile because it's Jason Bay's profile. It's not a player that ages well. There's not some sort of stabilizing skill here. Like, you know, he doesn't walk all that much. The power obviously is great, and he's, you know, hit for power pretty much every year, but that's sort of a function of his ability to make contact. He's never done it all that well, but, you know, now it's getting to the point where it's sapping the power because he's just, you know, striking out at alarming levels. So I have to say I'm nervous about him. I do think he'll bounce back because, like you said, you do at this point in the year want to put a lot more weight towards the largest sample being his entire career prior to this point, which is it's been a really strong career. So I feel like we're okay. There's enough upside here that we're still going to see a player who is going to help the Mets throughout the rest of the season. That said, it really makes me concerned about, you know, we've got three more years of this coming after this year. And it makes me worried about those last couple of years, especially if he's already sort of starting to show the signs What is it going to look like in a couple of years?
Yeah, those, again, those last 2 years of the deal were always probably going to be bad. If it comes the last 3 years of the deal and those last 2 years get really bad, well, that's not good.
Yeah, I think the question would at the onset would have been if those last 2 years are like really, you know, not able to stay on the field.
Yeah, it's sort of like you just eating the fourth year of that contract.
Yeah, then at that point, are we all so comfortable with the deal like we seem to be? I don't know.
We'll stick in the Mets outfield. Our next email is from Carrie. Good morning, Jeff and Rob. Pueyo batting at the bottom of the order. What's up with that? Best, Carrie in NOLA.
I like the brevity.
Yeah, I do too. We got a lot of emails to get through, so shorter is welcome. Yeah, he's had a lot of... It's not even that he's batting at the bottom of the order, which is stupid. He's had a lot of days off. And I know you think it's a nagging injury, but he's pinch hit in at least most of those games, so I have no idea. I thought the Abreu call-up would kind of force Wally's hand if it was a Wally thing. But he's still playing Andrew Brown in right field and Anthony Saratelli in left field a lot with Dendecker in center. And at this point, you know, at what point is Cesar Pueyo more likely to help the major league roster than Andrew Brown? And they actually kind of have similar skill sets in a weird way in terms of lefty mashing. And Pueyo's obviously a better athlete with a lot more upside. Maybe you don't want to bring him up when he's just going to be, you know, spelling Granderson against 15 tough lefties, but there's just no... Even if you think Cesar Pueyo is like a fringy starter, fourth outfielder type, if you don't think the swing's going to get there against major league pitching, he should still be starting every day over Anthony Saratelli, Andrew Brown, and Matt Dendecker.
Yeah.
Because he's still a better prospect than all of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, I look at it as... They're keeping their major league assets warm. And with Brown, I get it. He's to this point, he's proven he's a major league asset. I mean, as of right now, he's batting 185 at the major league level. I think last year he showed you he can definitely have some value. He's what you would call a major league asset. Matt Dendecker, I think he's proven, obviously not so much at the major league level, but I mean, he doesn't really need to prove out his worth much more than he already has in AAA. I mean, he's a guy who can bring really strong defense off the bench and some pop. I mean, he's at this point, he's close enough that he's think you could call him a major league asset. What concerns you is when Anthony Saratelli is playing over Pueyo. That he is not a major
league asset. In left field while Eric Campbell is starting at shortstop.
Yeah, I mean, you're really going hard out of your way to make that happen. And while Pueyo, I don't think you can call him a major league asset at this point. You can say he's going to be, and there's a good chance he's going to be, but he's certainly not yet. But nor is Saratelli. So that's what leads me to that. Even goes beyond like a Wally thing. If like Wally just has a beef with him, that's when it gets to the point where the only explanation to me is nagging injury.
Yeah, see, I don't know. It's weird to me. I mean, there's been a lot of weird things around Pueyo over the last year. There's a Baseball America report that there's people in the Mets front office that don't see him as a prospect. You know, obviously there's the lingering biogenesis thing. And look, he hasn't really hit that much. He has a 19-2 strikeout to walk ratio. You know, he's not, I figured he would kill Vegas, but he isn't getting regular playing time. Maybe he is, maybe it is a nagging injury, but it just, you would think somebody would be looking into it or something would have leaked out that it's like, oh, he's dealing with a oblique thing or a hamstring thing or a intercostal or back strain, whatever.
I'm gonna go out on a limb and say upper body, because that, right. Any of those things, I think would have put him on the DL. Even, I mean, the minor league DL, you don't have to wait 2 weeks. So maybe it's like a hand or an arm injury that like he can take the random at bat every day or two. Otherwise, again, I don't see how any of it makes sense.
I mean, hopefully it'll work itself out, because it's bizarre to me. You know, I'm a Pueyo aficionado, obviously. But I mean, even if you just think he's, you know, an okay top 20 type prospect, he still should be getting reps over, Matt Dendecker and Andrew Brown. Because, I mean, at a certain point, we're not there yet, but there's absolutely a scenario where he could have sort of hit his way into being the next guy up by, like, May 15th. It hasn't happened, but he also really hasn't gotten an extended opportunity to do it.
Yeah, I think we discussed it on the show that it wasn't hard to see him as, like, the Lagares of this season. And yeah. So far, he just hasn't had the opportunity to make that case.
He should, because I really want to now order a custom Las Vegas 51s Pueyo jersey, which you can do. I just found out, in addition, if you haven't seen it, St. Lucie has Brandon Nimmo jerseys with the Finding Nemo font that you can order from their website. And that encouraged me when I was looking at that to see if there's anything else interesting in the various team shops. And Vegas is now offering custom jerseys in both blue and white. So if you want a Noah Syndergaard or Rafael Montero or Cesar or Alan Dykstra, you all seem to really like Alan Dykstra a lot. All available to you now in the Las Vegas 51s shop.
I'm happy to hear that because I am a big supporter of minor league jerseys. You don't see them often beyond just the team logos for obvious reasons. The players don't hang around all that long. No. But I rock a old Alex Gordon Wichita Wranglers t-shirt to this day.
That's nice. That I would wear that. I have a custom, obviously, a custom Bisons Josh Satin jersey, which is sort of my
actual jersey,
which is sort of my default City Field jersey. I spent the big bucks. I was annoyed they didn't have they only had it in the home white, which I'm not a huge fan of. They didn't have the old blue and black orange. I can remember if their alternate or their, I think it was their alternate home jersey, I think, in 2012 when I got it. They didn't have that, but it was only the home white. But I wear it. It's cool.
On the bright side, the Vegas uniforms have grown on me. I didn't like them at first, but
I think the blue, I don't know if it's the alternate or the row, but the blue ones are really nice.
I could see getting maybe a Montero custom jersey in blue. I think I'd look good in that.
Our next email is from Calvin, who's Met City on Amazon Avenue, and he's back with some more quick hits. Hello, Jeff and Rob, comma Chris, comma or other. I got a few more quick hits to discuss for the next podcast. Yes, and our first quick hit here, Rob, inquires as to the situation with a certain position on the New York Mets. Starlin Castro is probably not available. Yes, it's Shortstop Avenue Audio. Jerks and Profar? A Bridge Too Far? How about Wilfredo Tovar? It's Shortstop Avenue Audio. What about Chris Owings' Park Effects? Is Sandy really checking his Rolodex? All these questions and more. Frankly, anyone who grades out as a 4 is on the agenda for Shortstop Avenue Audio. Yes, it's back. Shortstop Avenue Audio. How much leash does Tejada get before the team makes a move, i.e. calling up Flores? End of April? May? June? Follow-up, how bad does he have to be for the team to make the move? He's currently hitting, this was 12 days ago. It's gotten a little bit better, but not much. 195, 267, 220 with a 33 weighted runs created plus. So I'm assuming if he's still around there by May, he gets the boot. All right, Rob, the Mets are 14 and 11. We sort of did this with Chris 2 weeks ago, talking about different bullpen arms, one of whom is already off the team in John Lennon. But how much leash do you give Ruben Tejada on a team that, you know, with the Bryce Harper injury to, you know, putting a bit of a crimp in the Nats plans, could they possibly be competitive? I don't know, but they're certainly not going to be competitive with Tejada at shortstop, so what do you do?
This is a very timely question for me because I've begun beating the drum that I'm ready to relegate him, whether to bench duty or minor league duty, don't care. He's not a starting major league shortstop hitter, whatever you want to say. He's not the answer, and there are at least enough other not good options, just other options that we can't keep running them out there. And at this point, the numbers are, he's batting 200. And you know what? A Ruben Tejada supporter, of which there seem to be, aside from Terry Collins, who has to support him, there are a decent amount of them.
Patrick J. Flood, I think, most notably.
Yep, there's one. They could easily go to that on base, because right now it's a 316 on base, which, hey, that's a representative number. That's something that, if accurate of his talent level, would keep him in the lineup.
Well, the 215 slugging might be a bit of a problem.
Yeah. So again, that brings us back towards the relegate side. But, you know, even the on base, the 316 on base, that's bolstered by a league leading 5 intentional walks. It's a statistical anomaly. That's half of his walks right there. Without them, the on base is in the high 200s. Suddenly, you're looking at a player who, had he not been walked 5 times by nothing of his own doing, he's a guy who absolutely couldn't keep himself in the lineup and wouldn't be in the lineup right now. Again, the only reason he is because of happenstance. To me, Flores is a better option at this point, and he's not crushing it in Las Vegas, batting 250. He's got 1 home run.
He jammed something, too. But he's been hotter lately as well.
Even, you know what? I'm going to say it. I'd even rather see Quintanilla on a regular basis.
No.
I knew you wouldn't like it.
No.
No one's going to like it.
Call up Tovar, seriously.
Hey, you don't have to.
I know I don't have to argue with you about that.
I don't get why he's at AA, really.
He's in the jingle for a reason.
Well, really any of them. I think Tejada's time is, it's very much like I said about Davis. He's been given the opportunity time and time again. How many times does he have to prove to you that it's not gonna work?
And hey, you know, I don't know if this team is any good, but we're 25 games into the season. They've banked 14 wins. It's like, how long do you carry a potential -2 WAR player? And I think you could ask that same question about Granderson, who's been just as bad, but there's certainly a much longer track record of Granderson being good, and being quite good, and being an all-star level player. So I think that's a separate argument. You know, Tejada, this is now his second season of just atrocious, sub-replacement, unplayable baseball playing. So I think we're pretty close to the point where something is going to happen. I think another 2 weeks, you know, May 15th, assuming Flores, whatever he jammed, I wasn't even paying attention. I assume it was a hand or maybe an ankle again, but assuming he's healthy.
It was a finger injury.
The finger injury, okay. I assume stopped sliding head first poorly, but assuming he's fine, whatever, doesn't miss any time, hits a little bit, I think we're getting close to the Wilmer Flores starting Mets shortstop era. And the fact that I'm okay with this, I think, is a testament to just how much I don't want to see any current shortstops on the roster continue to play shortstop.
Yeah, that tells you all you really need to know at this point.
Elvis Andrews is probably not available. This has been Shortstop Avenue Audio. Francisco Lindor. The bidding starts at Thor, so we'll be back next week with more Shortstop Avenue Audio. Oh, the saddest of phrases, Tejada to Murphy to Davis. Surely Sandy is going to save us for more Shortstop Avenue Audio. Now this jingle is getting laborious, but don't forget Didi Gregorius, because soon we'll be down to just Flores on Shortstop Avenue Audio. Continuing on with Calvin's quick hits, this actually is, again, as we said, the entire email bag is kind of untimely. How valuable is a fifth outfielder in reality, and why do the Mets feel that having 3 first basemen is more important? Obviously, they don't still have 3 first basemen unless you count Daniel Murphy, which is, you know, fine. So I guess it's like how, yeah, major league benches are weird now, and I'm not entirely sure I like it. You don't, the 13 to 12 breakdown, especially, I mean, we saw it for a week. the Mets were just fine not using J. Urisfamilia. I think that sort of speaks to the fact that you don't really need seven relievers, especially when you have guys like Torres and Herman that can pitch multiple innings and have been at multiple opportunities. And that's, you know, Terry's bullpen management is another issue, but you know, being able to carry that sixth bench player can be important because it allows you to carry, you know, maybe a pure pinch hitter like Justin Turner or you know, a Billy Hamilton that doesn't even hit as well as Billy Hamilton to pinch run, you know, or a big, you know, guy you can stick in center as a defensive caddy or a defensive caddy at, you know, at shortstop, which you might need if you're playing Wilmer Flores at shortstop, or a third catcher so you can. I think about a third catcher so they could pinch hit Anthony Recker more, but Terry seems to be more willing to pinch hit his second catcher more than he has been in the past. Granted, the Mets have played a fair amount of extra inning games, and he's burned through his bench pretty quickly in some of those, but it allows you to carry Bobby Abreu, who really shouldn't be playing the outfield, but whatever. How valuable is a fifth outfielder? I think sometimes we get a little too obsessed with sort of leveraging every single spot on the 25-man roster, and it really just doesn't. You're getting so little value around the margins. Like, you know, I will fight anyone to the death that suggests calling up Eric Campbell or Zach Lutz and optioning Josh Satin. But, I mean, in the end, it's just not going to be that big of a difference over the course of 162 games. And realistically, you know, maybe 100 plate appearances. So having, you know, Kirk on the roster instead of Abreu, or Kirk on the roster instead of a third catcher or whatever, going to make a huge difference. We're a long way away from sort of like, you know, 1980s benches or like heavy platooning and stuff like that, where you really see the value.
Yeah, I guess I would say with a team like this, you need to squeeze out any additional value you can wherever you can. So I'm okay with them trying to maximize that, you know, if it's going to be like 0.2 war out of like Kirk or whoever that fifth outfielder is going to be.
I'm not entirely sure they're doing that, but that's a separate issue as well.
Yeah, very fair point. Obviously, there's a couple of different machinations going on with the rosters as it's currently constructed. That said, the fifth outfielder isn't going to ever be that valuable. But with a team like we have this year, where, you know, they might be competitive, but if they're going to be, they're going to be like right on the fringes of it. Any additional value they can squeeze out anywhere is going to be important.
I do think one thing to keep in mind here, too, in terms of bench construction, is this is a team that is going to have to win a lot of low-scoring games. And by definition, if you're going to win a lot of low-scoring games, you're going to win a lot of close games. So reliever usage is going to be very important. But, you know, maximizing your ability to, your run prevention ability in late innings. So that, you know, maybe you look at maxing out a defensive outfield if you're up one run late. You know, play, you know, like a three center fielder's defense. You know, keep Neuenheis around to play left, Young for right, Lagares for center when he's healthy. Or, you know, if somebody's sitting that day for whatever, bring them in as late inning defensive replacement. You know, roster Wilfredo Tovar and pull Daniel Murphy in the eighth and ninth inning of games. Again, Collins just isn't that tactically aggressive, so I just don't think you're going to see that happen. For the same reason, I don't think you're going to see, like, what I suggested on Twitter is calling up Jacob deGrom and just having him on standby. I mean, using him as a long reliever, but with an eye towards, all right, if Henry Mejia is having issues in the sixth, DeGrom's coming in the game. Allowing you to have that quicker hit with Mejia, or quicker hook with Mejia, so you have that guy, you know, ready that can pitch multiple innings. Because this is a team that if they're going to be competitive, they really are going to need to get every sort of marginal advantage they can.
And see, that's where you had me with the Satin discussion. There's not going to be a lot of value between Satin, Campbell, Lutz, whoever it's going to be.
Yeah.
But that's why I'm more willing to give Satin the hook if he
can. Campbell and Lawton, like, here's the thing. Yeah, they're playing Eric Campbell at second base and shortstop. Eric Campbell's a first baseman. He's not even a good left fielder.
Yeah, I mean, it's
just that you can talk about positional flexibility. You're not playing Eric Campbell at second base or shortstop at the major league level. You really shouldn't probably even play him in the outfield.
Yeah, no, I don't look at any of them as, you know, fielders. I look at them all as hitters, pinch hitters who maybe they spell whomever on any corner really. But for the most part, they're all hitters. And I think Satin proved to you last year that player can be valuable. I mean, he was worth 1.2 WAR. That's a win. So, you know, if they're in the thick of it and they're somewhere around like 87 wins and they're in the hunt for that second wild card spot, that additional win can be really, really valuable for them. And Satin proved to you that player can give it. However, he's proving to you this year that guy, that profile, typically it's a year-to-year sort of thing.
It's also like 20 plate appearances. I mean, he's a guy that really, I think when he had success last year, it was being able to play more regularly.
Yeah, I shouldn't say he's proving anything right now, but I think what I mean is...
I mean, like anything else, it's a small sample. You're talking about 120 plate appearances a year or so.
Right, and actually, that's sort of what I'm saying. And we got into an interesting discussion on Twitter about this. For these guys, I mean, their year is going to be a small sample, and year in, year out. So to me, I'm trying everything I can to play the hot hand, and if it seems like Satin's just getting out of the gate slowly, whether it, you know, it's his own doing or not, I'm pretty quick to, you know, pull the ripcord and give the next opportunity to Zach Lutz if he's hitting, or Eric Campbell if he's hitting. Now, Campbell's a little tougher because he's not on the 40 man, but a guy like Lutz, who it's a pretty even swap. I mean, you lose an option on Satin, but that really doesn't matter. And suddenly you've got, you know, just another shot. And if that doesn't work out, swap him again, because ultimately, really doesn't matter with these guys. You're just trying to get that incremental value. And again, Satin brought it last year, and that little bit of extra value can really go a long way.
And our last quick hit, and I'm going to combine this with another email because they're on the same topic and not really a surprise, is waiting until the second half to promote a league-wide thing, or is it more of a Mets tradition for the farm system, i.e. why wait until then to promote Nimmo if he's still hitting like this by the end of May? We also have an email along the same lines from, let's see if I can find it. My Gmail is being annoying. I know I had, oh yeah, here it is. It's from David. I will actually pull up the right email from David. Dear Jeff, comma Rob, ... and various dogs. It's just one dog today. He's being obnoxious. For how long does Brandon Nimmo have to sustain his current level of production in St. Lucie before we can officially get excited? Keep up the good work, guys. Best, David. Oh, you feel free to get excited. Go nuts. Yeah, get excited now. Get excited, but don't expect a promotion. You know, Plawecki mashed in Savannah, and they still waited till the end of the first half. And there's a couple reasons for that. One, you know, it's 4 weeks of performance. It's just not necessarily meaningful yet. You know, I don't get to see St. Lucie really at all, so I don't know if there's something that's hugely changed in the skill set. But it's not meaningful yet. We don't know if this is really if he's really dominating the Florida State League. It sure looks like it, and all the available evidence is pointing in that direction, but it doesn't really change the timetable. It's like whether he's called up to Binghamton May 15th or June 15th, he's still going to, you know, get a full half season in Binghamton. If he hits there, he could start next year in AAA. It's just not, those extra month isn't going to make a huge difference for evaluation purposes. And keep in mind, Binghamton, you know, there's not a lot of outfield room in Binghamton right now, and you still got a player development system that's trying to make evaluations on guys like Darryl Siciliani, Corey Vaughn, Travis Tyrone. So giving them another month in AA as starters to see what you have there has value for the organization as well. Look, none of those guys are going to block Nimmo come the Florida State League All-Star break, but it does just gives you more information, which is, I think, important.
Not to mention the fact that St. Lucie is the flagship organization in the team's minor league system, and it's always fun when they can win that first half title and ink a playoff berth. And obviously, letting Nimmo hang around definitely solidifies those chances.
And this is less of an issue for St. Lucie than it is for Savannah, since the Mets own St. Lucie. But you keep the affiliate happy by keeping a good player and a good team there. And look, there's value in winning. There was a fan post on this subject recently as well, and a piece by Lynn Worthy, who's the Binghamton Mets beat reporter. There is value in these guys, you know, learning how to win at the minor league level. It's not your primary developmental motive. But, you know, it's nice. Give them a full half season there. Let them chase a title. Let them, you know, feel the pressure of a playoff race. Let them get an all-star game appearance. You know, it's a nice benefit for the player to go through that process. There's value in that. Again, it's not slowing down a developmental timetable. It gives you the opportunity to, I think, with Nimmo, see, eventually you would think the Florida State League is going to adjust back to him. To a certain extent, I don't think he's going to start hitting 150 a couple weeks or anything, but it gives him a chance to make secondary adjustments at this level before you throw him into the fire of Double A, and that's a big jump. And you also just don't see that the organization doesn't do this, for better or worse. You know, the rare exceptions recently have been, and it's certainly more on the pitching side than the hitting side, Jacob deGrom, and that was mostly injuries. I think Pill got hurt, and then Mateo blew out his UCL, so he kind of got pushed a little quicker.
And he's older.
And Montero, who was old for his levels when they kind of rushed him through the system in 2011. But you don't really see guys, certainly not after 3 or 4 weeks. Now, look, if he goes, he's, what, 4 for 4 with a home run and double tonight. If he's still hitting 400 in 2 weeks, do they maybe consider pushing him? Look, if you think he has nothing left to learn at the level, then yes, promote him. I just don't know if you figured that out for sure in 6 weeks. And it's just one player. It's a whole developmental system. You got to sort of find at bats for and whatnot.
To sort of posit a developing skill that, you know, the team may be hoping to see and... I don't think we're really seeing out of Nimmo yet is the fact that he came into camp so much bigger and stronger, which we do like to see, but he's not necessarily driving the ball over the wall yet. That's certainly something that they could be waiting for. I mean, with all of the other evidence that you've sort of run through here, that's, you know, another sort of factor that can easily play into, you know, reasons why they might want to just wait until the All-Star break and sort of let this thing run its conventional course as opposed to really getting outside the box.
Yeah, and I think that's a good level to do that at. St. Lucie's a fairly neutral hitting park compared to Savannah, which, as we all know, is death, especially to left-handed hitters. But, yeah, I do wonder how much of it is. Obviously, he's always had very good command of the strike zone. You know, even going back to his first taste of professional baseball, or his first extended taste of professional baseball in Brooklyn. But I'd almost, at a certain point, I want to have Jeff Moore on the podcast, who's a baseball prospectus writer who covers the Florida State League in depth and has seen Nimmo a bunch this year. I want to have him on the podcast and really get into this. I wonder how much of it is, I just kind of want to see him drive some balls, like get more aggressive and really sort of put, I mean, he is what he is as a player. I think a good batting eye and a high walk rate is always going to be part of his game. But especially, it's still advanced day. I mean, he's going to get fat 88-mile-an-hour fastballs in 3-0 counts, 3-1 counts. You know, I want to see him really put some sting into him, put a real sort of mark on that league before he's promoted. But, I mean, he'll be up after the All-Star break one way or the other at this point. So I don't think it's a huge deal. But you're right. It's like, that's the one. If you adjust for his batting average on balls in play, that's sort of, his performance, it's better than last year. And it's a higher level. So it's good to see, but I don't think the triple slash probably over-exaggerates the progress he's made to a certain extent, as you would expect with the, over 500 on base percentage that he's running right now.
Well, I'm looking at St. Lucie for a guy who might move fast. I want to know when Steven Matt's going to Binghamton.
I think, again, you'll see him after the All-Star break. I think they'll be more willing to move pitchers at this point just because, there's available slots in that Binghamton rotation.
Matt's, to me, sort of checks off a lot more of those boxes that you described earlier, something like what DeGrom did last year. Nimmo sort of doesn't fit a lot. We just discussed the reasons why, but Matt's is a guy who's a little older. He's behind the curve a little and is clearly looking like he's catching up to it and is dominating at least as much as Nimmo, if not more. He's a guy that I would love to see get moved up before the break.
I mean, if he performs, I think he'll be there again after the All-Star break. He'll take either Gorski or Peavy or Pills spot in the rotation, and they'll go on from there. There's any number of those advanced A starters if they perform, and Matt's is the only one that's really doing that right now. But I mean, if they perform, there's a clear path to a half season in Binghamton.
I'm actively selling myself right now on this. I'm going to go out on a limb and predict that one injury, let's say it's going to be Tyler Pill, opens up a spot. Matt's has two or three more starts going the way he's going. The ERA is 1.52 right now. He's got 23 strikeouts and 23 innings with 4 walks. Let's say he keeps doing that. I bet he gets the call early.
See, that'll happen, and then they'll just use Angel Kwan, who's, I think, with the team but not rostered. Our next email is from Phil. Hey guys, the Mets aren't really hitting, even though it's still early, but they might want to consider changing the lineup in the near future. He wrote this when Granderson was still batting. This is 9 days ago, so Granderson was still batting fourth. Grandy isn't a cleanup hitter, and due to his power, is better served batting fourth. Would you consider leading off with Granderson, putting Darno second, and due to cleanup? Thanks for the insight, Phil. I'd probably go Eric Young, and again, this is Lagar, based on who's on the roster right now. Eric Young, Wright, Granderson, Duda, Chris Young, Murphy, Darno, Tejada, pitcher. Really pitcher Tejada, but that seems to have been abandoned fairly quickly. Maybe Darno gets to hitting second this year, but for now I'm fine with him batting seventh and just sort of letting him get hot, letting him sort of work on things without having to bat at the top of the lineup. I guess when Lagares comes back, maybe you consider batting Murphy leadoff or just put Lagares on top. I don't know. I just can't.
I don't know if you can make that move at this point. I think that's sort of like the unheralded
okay. Are you seriously going to make a case for Eric Young playing every day in leadoff right now?
No. What I will say is I think a lot of people owe Terry Collins an apology for deriding and dismissing the idea of Young getting the first shot at leadoff, and he's really running, taking the role and running with it. Will he continue to do so? Everything in the world points to him not, but right now he's thriving in that role, and I think that was beyond the expectations of many a Mets fan coming into the season.
His entire case for playing every day at this point is incredibly small sample size defensive metrics that I don't believe, but
yeah, that's true. He's not hitting.
He's not hitting at all. He's like he's a 260 slugging, and I know yes, on base is more important than slugging, but he has a 260 slugging.
I'm not ultra concerned about that, but he's not really hitting the ball at all for power or otherwise. So it's not a super sustainable profile to carry into the second month of the season. But hey, it worked for a month.
That's true. Like anything else, that's banked.
Exactly. He's on your fantasy team. You're happy. They're not going to take the stats back.
Our next email is from Will. Hey, Jeffrey and co-host. Is it too early in the season to ask you guys for your vote for the three most surprising prospects this season and also for your three biggest disappointments? And has anyone changed his status as a prospect in your eyes? Mine are Matt Reynolds, Phil Evans. These are Will's, not mine. Matt Reynolds, Phil Evans, and Stephen Sable. And you know, Flexen and Fulmer are his disappointments, so I feel that Fulmer will be fine once he gets past the knee injury. It probably is too early, but we're going to do it anyway because we like talking about prospects.
Yeah, really, it's never too early.
I concur, I think, with Will on a bunch of these guys. Reynolds and Evans, certainly. I mean, Reynolds, I wrote him up when I saw Binghamton, and he's not this good, but I think the results are starting to match the swing, or at least what I see out of the swing, and he's not, you know, major league shortstop, but I'm a little more confident he'll at least play at the major league level now. And Evans is, I saw, again, not a major league shortstop, but it's also good to see. I guess, who do you think, I know Toby had the, was it, I think somebody asked me and Toby this on Twitter this morning, but who do you think has sort of done more for their prospect status, Reynolds or Evans, through 3 weeks, for whatever that's worth?
Well, Reynolds is hitting more, but that's, and I'd pick Reynolds, but not for that reason.
Okay.
I'd pick Reynolds because defensively I could see him in the middle infield at the major league level, whereas Evans is just still too messy. And it, they're both showing you that they have a pulse at the plate, which is enough.
Yeah, I mean, if I was redoing my top 25 list, I don't think either would make it yet, but they'd be in the conversation. I think Evans is a little more upside. Again, not a guy I've seen a ton of, but, you know, he gets pull happy. He's not a great defender. It's not a great body, though supposedly he's in better shape now after he was at the Michigan camp. But outside of those two, I want to throw someone here for Jacob DeGrom, maybe.
On the pro side.
On the pro side. You know, he's pitching pretty well in Vegas. I do want to sit down and watch some video this weekend. I've been traveling pretty much constantly. And apparently I have Canisius versus Quinnipiac on my schedule. I have no idea why. I think I may just stay in.
And is there a player on either one of those teams?
I actually went back and looked at the Baseball America Metro Atlantic Athletic Conference.
That's my home preview conference. And I was going to say, I know of no players.
There's two Canisius players in the top 10 draft prospects. One's a first baseman who's not till 2015. And there was a pitcher, but he was the ninth best draft prospect in the MAC. So maybe I'm going to skip this one and catch up on some MILB TV this weekend instead. And I do want to see Jacob DeGrom because I want to see how the breaking ball is. And if he's starting to miss some bats.
DeGrom is interesting to me because for a guy who I mean, talk about Helium Watch. I haven't seen this much clamor from the fan base and just, you know, around the Mets in general for a guy who going into the winter, nobody knew his name.
Jacob DeGrom?
I'm talking about the mainstream.
Okay.
We knew his name. People listening to the show knew his name. But, you know, Joe Mets fan, some guy out at the stadium, some guy listening to WFAN, you know, not living, breathing Mets, didn't know who Jacob DeGrom was. And now, most certainly, I mean, his name pops up on the broadcast all the time. For a guy who sort of came out of anonymity, suddenly he's like such a hot name, and it's rare when something like that happens to such a degree.
And I'll give you one more too. I don't want to get too deep into him because I'll just end up scooping myself. So I'm running him up this week. Is Jeff McNeil?
Actually, I had to say that.
All right, Jeff McNeil, who I saw in Kingsport, and he just looked like a skinny dude that didn't really know how to play baseball, and he's still a really skinny dude that kind of looks like he knows how to play baseball. It's a very, very pretty swing. There'll be a lot of lazy golf comps in the report because he's basically a golfer that's learning how to play baseball, so it's very raw. But he has that kind of, like, if you look at the upper body trunk rotation when he swings, it's kind of golf-like. And he has that sort of top hand over the top follow-through like Murphy. Goes to the opposite field naturally. A little bit of pull power. Almost pulled one out in BP for a guy that's basically my size. He's listed at, I think, 6'1", 60, but I don't think he's 160. You know, usually those weights are out of date in the other direction, but it's an interesting little player. It absolutely cannot bring that swing into games, especially against breaking stuff and stuff down in the zone in general, but if he figures it out, he's a really good athlete.
He's a really good shortstop.
Yeah, they have him playing at third, but it looks like he could. There's a little more there than just a third base profile. Now, granted, he needs to put on 25 pounds, which might, you know, limit him to third or second. But
I mean, between him and Cecchini right now, I think he plays a better short. But obviously, we know why he's not playing short right now.
Yeah. So, who are your surprises?
Let's say on the negative, Leathersich has been a. I mean, for someone who's repeating, he's going back two levels, back to a level that he dominated last year in Binghamton. He's having a lot of trouble with Double A again.
Yeah, I'm not. Like I said, I saw him in Binghamton. He looked like just another bullpen arm to me. I was more impressed by, like, you know, John Velasquez, who, after I said that, promptly has just gotten tattooed since I left New Hampshire. But I still like him better than Leathersich. But it's like 91 to 94. Like, everybody in that bullpen is like 91 to 94. You know, Satterwhite has a little more velocity. You know, Chisholm and Kolarik have a little left, but they're a little less, but they're left-handed. But everyone, you know, Leathersich, Bradford, Church, you know, Satterwhite's got a little bit more. Velasquez is in that general range. You know, it's all 91 to 94 with the breaking ball. It's just not special anymore, if it ever was, and I'm not entirely sure it was.
Yeah, obviously people thought it was. I mean, coming in, I mean, talk about a name who we heard a lot about this winter. There was talk that he was going to break camp with the club, and it was pretty surprising that he didn't make the 51s bullpen. And maybe it's, you know, a confidence thing, or like a sort of bummed out about being in Double A, and so the performance is reflecting that. But in any case, this doesn't look like a guy who should have been discussed as a major league arm at any point, let alone right now.
Yeah, I'm not really worried about Yanoa and Fulmer yet. They've had a couple of decent starts and a couple of bad starts. You know, for Yanoa, the A to advanced A jump isn't huge, but it's a tougher home park. It's better hitters. He's going to have to work on some things. His last start was pretty decent, as was Fulmer's. Fulmer's had a couple nightmares in there, so it's kind of skewing his early season numbers. I'm not particularly worried about them. Domingo Tapia, yes. You want to stick in the advanced A rotation. He's just not missing bats. I don't know why. It's very sad to me. And I'll throw one more in there. Again, I'm going to be scooping myself a little bit. Dominic Smith.
You worried about him?
Yeah. It was not good.
How so?
Well, if you read Mike Newman's report over at Roto Scouting, he covered a lot of the issues. He's just not staying back on balls. Like, he's trying, it almost seems like he's trying so hard not to strike out that he's just making such weak contact. Like, his BP session was okay. He's just not staying back and letting the swing be the swing. Like, I'd almost rather he was striking out, you know, he's an 18-year-old in the Sally League. I'd almost rather he was striking out 20 to 25% of the time and just staying back and trying to drive the ball. He did it kind of on one, in one at bat on Sunday, where he stayed back and hit one back up the box. I'm looking at the video. It's just, and I'll have the video posted when I do the report. It's just not good right now. The body's gotten thick and not in a good way. And again, he's only 18. He's a first baseman, fine, but it's something that's going to need to be monitored. It's just not, you know. And again, it's a 2013 draft. It's a marathon, not a sprint. And I don't want you to take this as sort of a condemnation of Smith, but I, you know, seeing him next to J.P. Crawford, the Phillies' first-round pick from 2013, who's a little bit older, but they're both prep picks. Crawford's a stud.
Far more athletic.
Well, certainly, and he's a shortstop, but that makes a difference. He's a shortstop. He's a major league shortstop. So that gives him a much larger margin for error with the bat, and the bat's raw. He absolutely destroyed a Chris Flexen pitch, one hop to the advertising signs in right center in that park, which is not easy to do. But I mean, that's the guy that you see and you're like, okay, that's got all-star upside. You know, he probably doesn't get there. But with Smith, there's a lot of pressure on the bat. And it doesn't look good right now. You know, this is also something that Newman wrote. I don't think the Mets will do it, but, you know, he might end up back in Brooklyn when short season ball starts. I would not be shocked.
Yeah, it'd be a pretty aggressive move. And, you know,
like it's not something they like to do. The last person I can think they did that with was Javier Rodriguez. And that was a different organization. I think that was 2010. Maybe it was 2011. But yeah, we'll see. I don't want to like super sound the alarm bells, but you're talking about early season disappointments. We're talking about 3 weeks. And what I saw, I put Dominic Smith on that list.
That's bold, because like you said, he's 18 in the salary league. I didn't see him, but I'm not concerned.
No, I mean, you absolutely expect him to be overmatched. That's not my main concern. It's just how he looked, you know, physically, the swing, you know, it's low energy in general.
What you keep hearing about him in early reports is speed of game, and not in a good way.
Yeah.
That speed of the game is just on both sides of the ball is overmatching him. And you know what? Again, that's what I'd expect to hear at this point. And so to me, I don't even know on my radar, I wouldn't even say it's a blip on my radar, but again, I didn't see him in person. So easy for me to say.
Yeah. Like I said, I'm far, far from being worried yet, but it was kind of put in stark relief for me seeing him next to Crawford this past weekend. And our last email is from Adam, and it is about a subject near and dear to my heart. Hello, hello. Mejia's 80 hair has got me thinking. In recent Mets history, does anyone top it? Who are some of the other contenders outside of the Mets? For me, it's tough to beat early 90s Juan Guzman. Good choice. Also, don't know if you all have done this before, but he included a link to his Sporkle quiz on Mets opening day lineups from 1991 to 2014. I feel like I have taken that actual quiz before and not done particularly well with it. Last question. Has either of your minds changed on offering Murphy an extension? Flores being the heir apparent. I'm kind of disappointed he didn't say hair apparent, just to keep him with the subject of the email, but hasn't exactly shown much. Thanks, guys. Adam. All right. You know, the Mets, Guzman had really good hair, but it wasn't quite, I never quite got to the length of Mejia's. It's kind of similar hair, but never quite got to where Mejia is now, which is just, you know, elite level. I mean, after seeing him, there's a photo in our editor right now, which somebody needs to use. I may just use it for the podcast post, because F it. Of him walking off the mound in the rain in his last start with his hat off, and it's just like, you know, hashtag wet. There's just no other way to describe it.
Literally wet.
I think, now I do want to say we got post-peak Pedro hair, as well as post-peak Pedro, but that was also still amazing. I think also overlooked, he didn't have this when he was a Met. If he did, I think I would have reacted much more badly to the trade. But Angel Pagan's hair right now is impressive. Really the whole look.
Yeah, talk about crazy hair. The mane is just...
If they had traded him with that hair for Ramon Ramirez and Andres Torres, totally would have changed my view of the trade.
How about, here's one, Mets bullpen coach Ricky Bonus. Never as a Met, but if you look back to his playing days...
All right, let me Google this. I'll take a look. I don't have a...
Pull it up on Google Images. You don't have to look hard. Although specifically, if you want to look at like really like his hair in its peak, look for the Brewers.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I got a...
It's like a little like Jerry Curl mullet going on with
it's not...
Pretty solid, like pencil thin mustache is just like adding to the effect.
Not really doing it for me. I'm kind of picky. And I guess this isn't entirely fair because you kind of have to include the sideburns and the mustache, but peak Eddie Murray.
It's all about the mustache
It
there.
is, but it connects to the hair, so it is kind of all one unit in its own way. And he still had, like, he had a pretty decent fro. Again, not Mejia. I mean, Mejia's really breaking the scale. It's like Billy Hamilton speed. I mean, you can throw a Pedro comp on that hair and not have it be silly.
I'll concur with that statement.
Okay, how about Daniel Murphy extension? Any?
Nah.
Yeah, I feel the same way. It's like, it's just not a guy you pay free agent dollars to, I feel like.
Yeah, he's just too fungible commodity. I mean, it's nice that we know what we're going to get from him, but what you are going to get from him isn't really far removed from what you can get for relatively cheap dollars in the free agent
And
market. I mean, look at what
he's
look
not
look at
young.
he's not young. His game is, I mean, it's weird when you have a player who sort of like changes from year to year. Like this year, he looks like a guy who's never going to hit a home run again. And I mean, it's not to say that he's a bad hitter. He still stings balls into the gaps, and he gets plenty of line drives. But he is not hitting for any sort of extra base over the wall power. And you look at what the Yankees are getting from like Kelly Johnson slash Brian Roberts. It's not all that different, and they paid nothing for that.
I mean, outside, I mean, if the doubles come or you get some over the fence power, it's just another Murph season, which is fine. Again, it's you have him for one more year, probably for 8 or 9 million, at which case he'll be entering his first free agent season would be age 31. I just don't, and you give him an extension now, what are you doing, 3, 4 years? It's just, I don't think it's worth it.
He's not a guy that you have to worry about buying out his arb years, because he's not going to put up the sort of numbers that are going to break the arb scale. He's not going to make,
Yeah, I
Eichel is the
mean,
sort of guy who could have by putting up lots of power numbers. Murph's not going to do that, so you don't have to worry about paying, $10 million in his arbitration years.
he's a good hitter, but he's not probably going to hit 300. He's not going to hit, even 15 home runs. He's stealing some bases, which might,
Yeah, he's turning more into like a
it's such
stolen
a
base
weird
threat.
profile, but I
I'm
mean,
telling you, it changes from year to year, and it sort of worries me. But then, at the same time, I was about to say, probably the best thing about Murph is that you know what you're going to get from him year in and year out. So I guess there's not a lot of
I mean, he's like the
to.
Dylan Gia position players to me. You take what surplus value he gives you now while he's cheap, and then you find somebody else to play second base. They have plenty of options coming up in the next couple of years that could theoretically give you something like that.
Agreed.
So that wraps up our emails. There were eight of them. We did them all. Again, you can email the podcast at podcast. Oh my God, we did an hour and a half already. Ugh, I've been so good about keeping things short, and then we had eight emails. We can never take a week off again. You can email the podcast at podcast at amazonavenueaudio.com. This is episode 65, Amazing Avenue Audio, the Ike Davis Dog is Traded edition. Amazing Avenue Audio is the official podcast of your SB Nation New York Mets site, Amazing Avenue. You can find us at amazonavenue.com on the internet. Follow us on Twitter at Amazing Avenue. Friend us on Facebook, www.facebook.com/AmazingAvenueFans. Find the podcast on iTunes. Just search for Amazing Avenue Audio, and you can listen or subscribe right there. I encourage you to do both. I encourage you to also rate and review the podcast. You can also find us on the Stitcher app. Download directly from blogtalkradio.com/AmazingAvenue or listen to the embedded player that goes up in the podcast post at Amazing Avenue proper. I'm your host, Jeffrey Paternostro. You can find me on Twitter at Jeff Paternostro. My co-host this week was Rob Castellano. Find him on Twitter at underscore Robcast. And we will wrap things up this week with Mets trivia, which will involve me picking a year out of a hat, basically. But remind our listeners the trivia question.
the trivia question. As we sit through 25 games and the Mets are 14-11, recall for me the season in which they had their best record through 25 games. And you know what? If giving you a finite pool of answers wasn't enough, I will also accept the worst record through 25 games. So you have two opportunities here.
Yeah, but I would pick different seasons for. Yeah. All right.
Well, obviously. So you got to, you know.
Oh, right, I see. Okay.
Go for the other, go for both.
All right. All right. Well, keep it interesting. I'm just going to. I feel like there's a few years they got off to really hot starts. I'm going to go with 1988 for their best record through 25 games.
88 is a strong guess. but
I know what that means, yes.
No, my but here comes a butt tone.
Yeah.
And actually, 88 is number two on the list. Mm. So very good guess.
Almost kudos to me.
Do you care to wager a second? Because you're very, very warm.
All right. The only other one that would have come to mind is 87, because I know it wasn't 86.
You should have just stopped while you were ahead.
So it was 86. All right. It was 86.
The Mets started the season 20-5 that year. And just for future reference.
I've read The Bad Guys 1, too. I should probably know that. But
the answer to all of these questions in terms of best record through.
Yeah, so it's probably 1986.
Always 86. They started hot, continued to play hot, and then finished hot.
I mean, they were terrible in 62, so that was that their worst record through 25 games?
No, that's actually the surprising one to me. And I gave you this one because I thought 86 was at least gettable. 62, I thought would have been the obvious answer. 64, they went 6-19 out of eights. Interesting little tidbit as well. The Mets have been 14-11 three other times. In those three seasons, let's see here. In 89, they won 87 games. In 2008, they won 89 games. And then there's 2010, they were 14-11.
Yeah, and then the wheels fell off.
Well, and they won 79 that year, but I will say that that was when they were just decimated by a historic amount of injuries. So if that tells us anything, there might be something to this 90-ish wins plateau.
That went somewhere between 79 and 89 games.
Well, let's say that the injuries aside, they knowing that they could always be crippled by a historic amount of injuries, but let's say they don't. I sort of like their chances.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm still not convinced. But we'll talk about actual recent Mets baseball later this week for episode 66. We'll also talk about my Savannah trip. But we cleared out our inbox, so that was an accomplishment. Don't ever send us that many emails again. I love you all. And we'll see you later this week for more Amazing Avenue Audio.